We've come out here to fish, me and Quincy and Daphne and Aunt Glow. Daphne's got her lunchbox filled with rotten chicken necks. The rottener, the better for the crabs. So I move upwind past the stench. I've got my daddy's old rod and reel, the red one with the soft cork handle. It's got dents from where his fingers used to go. It's September now, and we've come out here to fish, but Quincy brought his skateboard, and he's riding it all the way to the end of the pier, pissing off the heron who was catching a nap. Quincy's wheels thrum drum through the cracks between boards, and that heron stretches out and takes off. If I could fly like that, I wouldn't even mind looking so prehistoric. The heron settles on a channel marker out there in the bay and pulls his head into his shoulders like somebody cold. Aunt Glow helps Daphne tie her chicken necks with string and dangle them down into the water. Daphne sniffs her fingers and says, "Ooh," but she must like the smell, the way she sniffs them over and over. "Ooh," she says, and scrunches up her nose. I've got my own cooler, and stashed inside it there's a can of soda, a pack of saltines, a plastic bag with my still-frozen squid, and an army knife sharp enough to cut it. So I dig out a piece of squid and saw it right there, add my slashes to the 1,000 already carved into this wood. I choose a good-sized hunk, the head, and hook it to my line. I hook it 3 times, through the flesh and through the eye, black juice squirting out at me, and when I cast, my line zings high and plops hard in the bay. Now it's the wait, the knock-knock of the line and deciding whether it's a crab or something bigger, the reeling in sometimes, the breeze on my face in the sun. It's September, but the sun's still hot, and when I close my eyes, I can pretend I'm on a boat sailing off to somewhere else. On that boat, heading north with my face in the wind, I can forget the sounds I heard last night, the banging around, the giggles and high-pitched shits. I thought at first it was just a dream, and those girls were at my door and making fun of me. It was late in the night, and when I woke up, I figured somebody was pulling a prank on old Jarvis Stanley right next door. But that was yesterday. With the water slapping soft against the wood, I pretend I'm a tugboat captain, pulling a barge loaded with gold all the way up to Annapolis. And I wonder if barges ever carry anything besides gravel or coal, if barges go to Annapolis at all. Annapolis is the farthest I've ever been, but someday I'll go farther. I'll go someplace where crazy things don't happen, where girls don't die like that girl died last night, right there in Jarvis Stanley's living room. Today, I plan to catch a flounder, maybe two.
You've been listening to Sherry Reynolds reading from the opening of her latest novel, The Sweet In Between. And Sherry is here in the studio with me. This is Rosemary Manchester, and you're listening to A Novel Idea. And we're looking forward to a wonderful hour with Sherry talking about her work, her writing, her teaching, her traveling. And you've already gotten a taste of her wonderful style and her very expressive voice with which she reads her work. Sherry is professor of writing and literature at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. She has a distinction of having a named chair. Now, you know, that's academically, that's a very important distinction. She has the Ruth and Perry Morgan Chair of Southern Literature at Old Dominion University. It sounds like a wonderful appointment, Sherry.
Well, the great thing about having that endowed chair in Southern Literature is that they have to let me teach it. When they hired me there, I was really hired to teach creative writing classes, and I love teaching writing classes, but literature is probably the best way I know of to teach people how to write. Mm-hmm. And so I like being able to blend the Southern Lit classes and also the writing classes, and sometimes I get to teach women writers as well.
Southern literature is probably one of our most interesting genres, don't you think?
Well, I think so, but I'm a little bit biased having grown up there and being so steeped in that culture.
So. Yes, I think it's so interesting that we distinguish. We don't say northern literature,
right,
or northeastern literature. And I think the regional distinctions are very interesting.
Well, certainly the Southern tradition is a distinctive one. And one of the things that is so powerful about it is you can't separate race from Southern literature and the whole history and the Civil War and, yes. you know, all that is all a part of it. And we may not think about it now, but we all have come up with that. And so I think that that brings conflict to any work that is written by a Southerner or set in the South.
And I think that you see it more and more coming into all American literature. I remember a very interesting novel called In the Fall by Jeffrey Lent. I don't know if he's Southern, but he was certainly influenced by the conflict that you speak of, and it's a novel that takes place at the time of the war between the states. Hmm. So that it's very interesting that you mention that as the underlying theme.
It's funny, in my own writing, I avoided race for so long because it's so complicated that I didn't know how to handle it. And I still haven't written the novel that I think is coming. I'm working on one that takes that on in a larger way. So it's more of a backdrop, but it's an enormous part of living in the South. And I think it's going to show up more as I age.
And you've written in a very, very sensitive way about religion in your book, The Rapture of Canaan. And I really appreciated the way, you know, that can be a very, very sensitive subject. And yet the way that you presented that material, I found it just most interesting and a very good way to get that message across.
Well, I'm glad you thought that was sensitive because I was worried about that. I think that especially in my earlier works, I was trying to work out a lot of my own conflicts, and I had a lot of religious ones. And I had a lot of anger, really, at the way that I was raised and in the religious community that I was raised in. And it's not an autobiographical novel, but parts of it are autobiographical. It's just buried in a fictional world. So I want to be sensitive. I mm-hmm. want to see all sides of things. But I was pretty mad when I wrote that one, so I'm glad it came off that way, too.
But I think only a person who had experienced that as a child could have written that.
Maybe so.
Well, I was raised in a religious home as well, but not a fundamentalist home. And I could not have imagined the things that you present in that book about what it's like to be a child in a Pentecostal church.
Right. Well, in The Rapture of Canaan, I created the world. It was called the Church of Fire and Brimstone and God's Almighty Baptizing Wind, and I made that up. But I used the same sorts of sermons that I would hear in the church that I did grow up in, and then I infiltrated it with bits of medieval law codes and created another rule book because that religion did not work out for me very well, but it did work for a lot of people in my family. I didn't want to make them too mad, so I wanted it to be something so that they might recognize the doctrine, but they say, oh, we never made anybody sleep in a grave, or we never said that. Mm-hmm. So there was always a way to escape from it for my family.
Mm-hmm. And that was your second novel.
That was the second
one. And that was the one when Oprah came calling.
Well, yeah, she did. But she actually didn't pick that novel until I'd already been kicked out of Putnam for it, and the book was remaindered. So it was a while after that Oprah chose it. It was about a year and a half after it had come out that she chose it.
We're going to talk about the Oprah experience because you're the first author that I've interviewed that's had the Oprah experience. But first of all, I want to get to your current book, which is called The Sweet In Between.
Yes.
The title, it draws you in.
Well, I think The Sweet In Between is a lovely title, but it wasn't my title for the book. And in fact, it's a very new title, so it's hard for me to even think of it this way. I always called this book Red Drum Running on a Falling Tide. And in the very first scene, they're out fishing on a pier, as you heard. And in the very next scene, they're going to start catching some red drum, and she associates with that fish. And it's a theme that runs through the book. But my publisher didn't think that my audience would know what a red drum was, and they didn't think that fishing imagery was the right imagery to market the book. So we went round and round on the title, and we came up with this one, and I like it. I haven't yet started thinking of my book this way, but it does work. Thematically, it works. It's just from a really different direction.
I didn't realize that authors don't get to name their own books.
They do sometimes.
Did you get to name your other books?
I named three of my five published books.
Ah.
So, yeah. I mean, I guess I named them all. I agreed to it all.
Right.
But I had a lot of help with a couple of them.
But your choice of names was not always
the
one that they took. So first the book at hand, The Sweet In Between. It begins and ends with fishing.
Right.
I like a symmetrical setup like that.
I don't always do a symmetrical beginning and ending, and I do like them sometimes, but sometimes I wouldn't want them that way. This one just emerged that way. The place was so important for this book. It's set on the Chesapeake Bay. My character is a young woman whose father is in prison. She's living with a family that loves her, but it's her father's girlfriend's family. And so she feels abandoned in some ways, orphaned in some ways. And at the same time, she has a home.
Yes.
So it's complicated in that way. But I think that for Kenny, my character, the place is the most grounded, the most grounding that she has, and that she turns to the natural world, and that she makes meaning of the things that happen to her through that landscape. And so I think that may be one reason that I brought the family back to the pier for the last scene, and I wanted the opening scene and the ending scene to look very similar, and yet the transformation that my character has been through has been enormous, but very small, very internal, but her sense of hope has really changed from the beginning to the end of the book.
Yes, because although she loves the place, she feels a little tenuous because she's 17. And when she's 18, her legal status will change.
Right.
And she doesn't talk about it at all to Aunt Glow, to her guardian, but it's constantly in her mind. I'll have to leave, and where will I go?
Right.
And that creates tremendous tension through the book.
So she has all this anxiety.
Oh, yes.
And that really carries the first half of the book, that at least by halfway through, Aunt Glow said, you don't have to go anywhere. You have a home. And so that, you know, that part is taken care of. And then we can go to the deeper part, which is it wasn't really about the physical. It's about the emotional sense of belonging.
Yes.
And so that's that was kind of a surprise, because I didn't know that that was coming as I was writing the book. And Aunt Glow, she's happy to keep her there, you know, that's fine.
And she says it so casually.
Right.
Oh, you don't have to leave.
Right. Yeah. And we do that, I think, in life so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all carry these burdens that we don't think we can ever state. And then when we do state them, sometimes they become so small comparatively to certainly given the amount of energy we've given them before. Mm-hmm. So.
And this little cluster of people that you read about on the fishing pier, they are a family.
They sure are.
They are. They technically, the relationships between them are unusual, but there's just no question that they've established a family with Aunt Glow, Aunt Gloria, as the head. And of course, she's not really Kenny's aunt at all.
Right.
Right. And Kenny's given name is Kendra, but because of the circumstances of her life, Aunt Glow's son, Tim Tim, has molested her sexually when she was quite small, and she has rejected the idea of being a girl. So she's doing her best to dress and act like a boy, and this creates some problems for her.
Right.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think one of the things that I really want to do, well, in my writing in general, I want to grow as a writer. I want to grow in my understanding of people and why they do the things that they do and make the decisions that they make. And I want it to be more complicated than that Tim Tim molested her. Yes, that did happen, but it's not really easy to just indict him either, because she likes him anyway. She just didn't like that. You know, I like that murky, ambivalent, kind of emotionally swampy place. I don't like clean answers. I keep trying not to write in a way that makes good and evil or monsters and heroes or that sort of thing. So I want that to come through. I hope that part comes through. I like the alternative family. Mm-hmm. I like to show, I mean, I just think it's the most ridiculous myth that most people have, families where there's a mother and a father and a boy and a girl child. I mean, it's just so silly. And I didn't really mean to do this, but I guess if I look back on all my books, I've done some alternative families before. And so that's important to me, to show that, just to put another example out there.
There are more alternative families than there are traditional families, but we're stuck with that myth.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And so let's blow it up.
Yep, let's blow it up. And I love the way that you handle the complexity. it's not black and white, it's gray. And her feelings are very complex. I wanted to ask you about the our readers, our listeners have already heard this alluded to in what you read, the fact that that there's been a shooting next door during the night, and you introduced that very early in the book, the violence of that shooting. Would you just build up a little of the circumstances under which that happened?
Yeah, all that. What happens is there's a rental property across the street from where Kenny lives, and there's been a mistake made on the rental agreement. So a group of girls who have come to rent a house for 5 days, I think, get there, and they don't see any of the landmarks they were told would be there. There's supposed to be a key under a fern on the porch, and there is no fern, and there is no key. They see a window open. They go into the window, and it is the other side of the duplex that Kenny lives in, and a man is living in that house. He had been robbed before. He comes downstairs, and he shoots the intruders. And the thing about that was so interesting to me is that they have a rental agreement with that address on it, and the girl's holding up the paper, the other girl that doesn't get shot, saying, but we rented it, we paid for it. The man, of course, thinks that he has an intruder in his house, and so he shoots. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a terrible, terrible accident.
Yes.
But Kenny is so uncertain in her world, and it's so scary the things that can happen to girls. And that incident sets off all this confusion in her about what's going to happen to me and who do I want to be and what if I'd been a boy? Could that, what would have happened? That's not supposed to happen to girls. That's what happens to boys. They get shot, girls get raped. And so she gets into these gender, it just sort of twists in her mind. I really wanted that, that violent scene to be one without a monster. Again, like both sides, the girls who had rented, the man whose house is being broken into, they both feel entitled to do what they've done, and yet there's this horrible outcome.
Yes.
And so that's the catalyst, really, that really undoes Kenny. I mean, she hears the gunshot. The girl from next door comes into her house while the police come. And so that is the emotional break, really, that says, how am I going to make it in this world when these kinds of things happen and I don't have the basic supports I need?
And throughout the book, she frequently mentions the girl who survived, whose name is Rhonda, and she wonders about her, wonders what she's doing, where she is, how she is. And in a sense, she's kind of wondering about herself, isn't she?
I think so.
Yeah.
The girl who dies gets all the attention. Of course she should. She died. But the girl who survived it, who isn't dead but went through it in the same way, is sort of an unknown, and she never knows what that outcome is. And so I think that she associates with that, mm-hmm. of being lost.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you to read another passage in the book that I was so taken with. It's a passage about Kenny's daddy, who is in jail through the entire book. He's in jail. And it's Kenny's take on her daddy.
That's what everybody says, that daddy's weak. My granny Eloise down in South Carolina, who can't raise me because her blood pressure's too high, wrote a letter to the judge before his sentencing. Daddy's lawyer got a copy of it, too. He's a spineless coward, she wrote. I'd rather see him in a pine box than in the shape he's in. I hope you lock him up a long time. But Daddy didn't get mad at her and told me not to be mad either. She's just disappointed, he said. She raised me right. Weren't nothing wrong with how she raised me. Aunt Glo popped him against the shoulder. Stand up to her, Greg, she said. You don't have to be spineless about everything. But after he was gone, Aunt Glo took me aside and told me how Daddy couldn't help it. He had an addiction, and it made him do things he shouldn't. It seemed to me just the opposite, like he didn't do the things he should, like get up in the morning and go fix somebody's car. All my life he'd fixed cars, until the year I was 12 and he just quit. He kept saying, I've got a job lined up for tomorrow. But then the next day he was still sleeping when we got on the bus, still sleeping when we got off of it. He drove around all night playing loud music, and after he lost his license and sold his truck, he rode all night on his bicycle. He hawked all his tools. He and Aunt Glo fought all the time back then because he sold a special ring she had, a sapphire ring she loved.
Then one day he told us he had a job lined up in New Jersey, helping a fella move some furniture, and he promised to take us all to the steakhouse when he was done. He told Aunt Glo that as soon as this job was over, he'd buy her blue ring back. But none of that happened. There was a sting operation on the interstate, and Daddy and his furniture friend were pulled over with a truckload of bedroom suits. There were drugs stashed in some of the dresser drawers, enough crack cocaine to send him to prison for a long time, 15 years and 8 months when they added in the charge for possessing paraphernalia, even though it was his first offense. Maybe he didn't know about the drugs, I said that night at supper, and Tim snorted and muttered, "You wish." Aunt Glo said the only reason in the world Daddy was involved in such a thing was his addiction. He just needed a fix. And if I've learned one thing, it's that we all need our fixes. Some of them are drugs, and some of them are other things. Tire stems if you're Quincy, sex if you're Tim Tim.
Hmm. Where does Kenny get her strength?
Kenny ponders things. Like, I think about at times when people do cruel things to her. There's a time when in the cafeteria where people don't want her to sit at their table. And she describes that like the seagulls, and how a seagull sitting on a piling will come run off a littler bird. And that it's not really all that personal. It's just the way nature works. And so she finds some sort of correlation in the natural world with what she's going through in her life and trusts in that.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps some of that comes from her mother, who died while she was still quite young.
She was little, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think some of it comes from Aunt Glo, too.
Aunt Glo, of
who
course.
Who is one of my favorite characters. I love Aunt Glo. And, you know, Aunt Glo's on prescription painkillers, and Aunt Glo's not always reliable, but she loves her, and she stands up for her. She stands by her. Mm-hmm. And I think that she sort of deflates things for Kenny. When Kenny gets, when things get really high-pitched for Kenny, Aunt Glo usually just drops it right back down. And so that helps. Mm-hmm. Everybody needs, if you're as high-strung as Kenny is, and I am that way myself sometimes, you need somebody to deflate it for you every now and then.
That's right. The public school is a disaster. I mean, your depiction of the school, I'm absolutely sure that you're right on target. But that's the way the school is. But it just makes you want to cry.
Well, you know, public schools can be really tough places. It's been a long time since I was a student in one, but I don't remember it being a very good experience mm-hmm. in that way. And I think that anyone who is different is going to be scapegoated. And Kenny is so different, mm-hmm. just in the way, I mean, it doesn't even matter that she's in a foster home. Mm-hmm. Just that she's passing as a boy mm-hmm. makes her just so different that she's bound to catch all that cruelty.
All that meanness, mm-hmm. right. Do schools invite you in to read or talk about your work?
Sometimes. I have this book is brand new out, and nobody's invited me yet for this one. Rapture of Canaan mm-hmm. is often taught to 10th, 11th, 12th graders. Mm-hmm. My novel, A Gracious Plenty, that's my third published mm-hmm. novel. They do that. They've done that a couple of times in some colleges mm-hmm. where there are these programs that they ask all of the first-year students to read the same book, and then they bring the writer in. And I just did that this past September at Wofford College, and I think I'm going to a college in North Carolina called Gardner-Webb in April to do the same program for the Rapture of Canaan. So students do get hold of the book, yes.
But that must be so interesting for you to find the universality that the young readers find in it. Although their situation may not be just that way, they identify.
I love talking with students uh-huh. about it. You know, in the classes that I teach, I teach both undergraduate and graduate classes, and the graduate students come there to work with me. A lot of them do. They know mm-hmm. that I write. Many of the undergraduates have no clue that I'm a writer, and that is fine with me. They always find out. But I don't use any of my own writing, of course, in the classes, mm-hmm. and I don't automatically talk about my experiences until it's natural to whatever we're covering. So when I get invited into other schools to talk about writing, it feels real different. Mm-hmm. It feels like that's why I'm there and that's what they want me to do. And I always enjoy that conversation with the students.
Mm-hmm. Your work and your material is built on realism. I mean, this is the way it
usually,
is.
Usually, yes.
Yes. I know that in some of your other books you had, you used some other techniques. But
yes.
I was thinking about the infatuation that so many young readers have now, so many young girls have with fantasy. I was thinking about the books that are so popular now about vampires.
I haven't read those books, so I don't really know.
No, I haven't either.
But I have read the Harry Potter books, and yes. I think that they, and they're certainly not realistic, but I think right. that they can teach you so much about how to think and how to see things. I mean, I think that there are a lot of ways to imagine how to work through things and how to find other opportunities and other ways to live and mm-hmm. and. That's what I think literature can do is give people a lot of insights about things that they haven't really experienced themselves.
That's right.
Sometimes it's too hard to read about something that is too real. And I think that this book could be real uncomfortable for some people. It made my niece, my 13-year-old niece, upset. She didn't understand. She didn't like the things that happened to Kenny. She didn't know why she needed to dress like a boy. She understood it, but she didn't like it. It made her uncomfortable. And she's probably liking mm-hmm. those vampire books, yeah. is what I'm guessing.
Yeah.
But there are people who will find some help, I think, in this book. I was reviewed in The Advocate for the first time ever, and I'm so pleased that the gay community will know about my book, because I think that it would be a really useful book for any teenager or young adult person who doesn't fit in for whatever reason in whatever way.
Mm-hmm. So. Anybody who's picked on because they're a little
right.
different.
Right.
Yes, would identify. And it seems to me that the young person who's never experienced meanness or cruelty or been an outcast, this might be very daunting to them to think, do these things happen? But on the other hand, for those who have experienced that exclusion from society or being picked on, I would think that they would see at last a book about me.
Yeah. Well, and my hope too is for the children like my niece who fits right in, that she will begin to see people she would consider an outsider in a new way. And, you know, that she would see more complication, and they're interesting. It's one of the things I love about coming to this part of the country and then being in San Francisco is how so many people embrace differences and love their individuality. And you can wear all colored socks and do funny things with your hair, and it's wonderful. And, you know, in the world that I live in, we don't see a whole lot of that. And so really, I guess I write in the hopes that it expands the people who don't see.
Mm-hmm. I know. I wish you could spend more time in Sonoma County, because that's one of the things we really prize is our individuality here. Yes.
I like that. I can tell that already.
Well, you must come back.
I think I will.
Yeah. Well, let's take a short break. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. I'm talking to Sherry Reynolds about her novel, The Sweet In Between, and we'll be right back.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. So far away. I'm almost gone. Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone. I'm so far away from home. Sometimes I feel like free. Sometimes I feel like freedom is near. Sometimes I feel like freedom is near, but I'm still so far from home. so far away from home. They're so far away. They're so far away. They're so far away from home.
All right, we're back. This is Rosemary Manchester. You're listening to A Novel Idea, and my guest tonight is Sherry Reynolds, the author of The Sweet In-Between. She comes from the South, as you can tell when you hear her very lovely voice, and she teaches and writes what we call Southern literature. I don't know why we have to specify the region of the country, but it is a very special special literature. And Sherry, as I mentioned before, you're the first writer that I've had the privilege of interviewing who has had her work selected by Oprah for Oprah's book club for your book, The Rapture of Canaan. And I'd like you to tell us, first of all, a little bit about that book, because it's a very, very special and unusual book. And then about the experience of being chosen.
Well, okay.
Okay.
It's been a while. And it feels almost like another person's life, mm-hmm. or like something I read rather than lived. But I did live it, and it was intense and exciting and wonderful. The Rapture of Canaan was my second published novel. And I make that distinction because I want people to know it's important for me that people know that this is my The Sweet In-Between is my fifth published novel, but I write a real stinker about every second time. So I have at least 10 novels. So Rapture of Canaan was my second published novel. And the story on that one is kind of funny. My agent, Candace Furman, lives out here, out this way in Mill Valley. And, she sold my first novel, and then she sold, I had a contract for the second novel, and I wrote this novel that was about the funeral industry. I thought that real writers did a lot of research and about things that they didn't know, and that they, you know, they learned a lot of things and then they shared them. And I decided to write about the funeral industry, and I studied embalming, and I did all kinds of research and took classes. And I wrote what Candace ended up calling an embalming manual. And she said, we can't publish this. Nobody would ever have it. I don't know why I read it. It's terrible. Start over. And I was really desperate. I was really scared. I was really young, and I didn't want to blow my deadline. I was being published by Putnam at that time. And Candace said to me, "You're a little Southern girl. You grew up on a tobacco farm. You know about fundamentalist religion. Why don't you write about that?" And it made me so mad. And I'm like, "You want to hear about that? I'll tell you what about that. I'll tell you that from my little girl's point of view." I was mad. And so I churned out The Rapture of Canaan very, very quickly, and it came out intact. And I made my deadline with Putnam, and it came out, and I was so pleased to have it out. And it sort of appeared and did okay and quietly went away, you know. And I think I had already been kicked out of Putnam. I had. My sales weren't high enough, and Putnam decided not to buy my next novel. And I didn't have a publisher for my next novel was called A Gracious Plenty. It was already written. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And I thought I was going to my writing career would be over before I hit 30. And then out of nowhere, or it seemed that way to me, Oprah just called up. I mean, I certainly wasn't expecting it. But I do remember that it was on April Fool's Day, and I didn't really believe that it was true when it happened. And she had chosen The Rapture of Canaan for the book club. It was the very beginning of her book club. I think I was the sixth or the seventh book that she chose. And it was stunning because I was fresh out of graduate school. I was teaching part-time and trying to do my writing. And so I was still living like a graduate student. I had a couple of roommates, and we lived in an apartment that hadn't been renovated since the 40s. And we were, you know, freezing in the winter, and we were poor. And all of a sudden, we were going to Oprah. And I had to borrow money to buy the clothes to wear on Oprah because I didn't have anything that would be nice enough to wear on national TV or anything like that.
Sounds like.
But it was stunning. And so it was immediate. As soon as she announced the book, you know, I think that the next week it was number one on the New York Times bestseller list and had sold 1 million copies by the time I made it out to Chicago to be on the show. And I guess I feel really lucky in a way that I had been kicked out of my publisher before that happened because I never got confused about the worth of the book. I mean, it was the same book after Oprah picked it that it was when Putnam kicked me out. And so there was that sense that, you know, what the world does with it, you can't really touch. You can only do your work. My work is to do my writing. And so I write. That's what I do. But it was a crazy, wonderful thing to do the Oprah show. And I had not had any experience in that world at all. I don't know that I'd ever ridden in a limousine before. I know that when Oprah called, my hair was about down to my shoulders. And when I get nervous, I start cutting. And by the time I made it on that show, I had a crew cut and they still worked on it for 3 hours in hair and makeup to try to get me ready for the show. But it was a bizarre, strange thing. But it gave me a set of readers that I would never have had. It introduced me to the world in a much bigger way, and was really an enormous turning point in my life. It took me a little while to get over it, to tell you the truth. It was very difficult for me to write because I didn't know how to follow it up. But time helps and aging helps and having a tenure track job really helped because I had to dedicate myself to getting tenure and not worry quite so much about the writing. And I've managed to get, you know, this is my third novel since that novel now. So I think that I've moved beyond it, but it was a life changing thing. And I couldn't be more grateful that she put me in, you know, in touch with people that, with readers that I would have never had without that.
It's a Cinderella story.
It was. Yeah, it really was.
I'm so happy to hear this. You know, it's so exciting to hear someone who's actually experienced it. And I didn't realize that how early in your career it was.
Yes. Well, that was it was in 1997. Mm-hmm. So it was 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I handled it just, I guess, in the perfect way for me to handle it at 29, which is how old I was when it all went down. It had my head spinning for some time.
You just enjoyed every minute of it.
I did enjoy it. Yeah. I did enjoy it.
She's made, Oprah's made a tremendous contribution.
Hadn't she?
To our literature for,
I know,
giving that prominence, particularly to emerging writers.
Well, she has. And she also has, she's kept the world reading good books.
That's right.
And people disagree with some of her choices. I haven't read a lot of them. I've read some of them. I might disagree with some of them in terms, but I think that she's given, most of that's about taste. And I think that her quality has been very high. Yes. I'm privileged to be in the company of the other writers she's chosen. I'm amazed that I had that chance, and think that what she's done for reading and book clubs and libraries is just phenomenal.
And just ordinary readers who are wondering what to read. Yeah, I printed out her list from the internet. Our listeners might be interested in what the Oprah books are. Just Google Oprah Winfrey books, and you'll find the list over. And then I was amazed at how many of them I'd read, and also amazed how many of them I hadn't. But 1 year, 3 books by William Faulkner. Now, how could anyone say she's a lightweight? I mean, William Faulkner, for goodness sake.
Well, some people are just going to say that because she's popular. And there's that whole, you know, that good literature's snobby. And, well, it's not, or it doesn't have to be. And I guess that I want to write to people. I'm not that smart myself, you know. I guess I really don't value that as much as I value imagination and human relationships and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I really appreciate and admire intellectuals and people who have such a big picture and who can put things together in a way that draws from a lot of different cultures. And I do, but that's not what I do. And so I'm not capable at this point of that kind of writing.
Well, she does have a nice variety.
She does.
And I was really astonished when Jonathan Franzen was selected for his book, The Corrections, and spoke very snidely.
Mm-hmm.
He felt it was somehow demeaning to be. I thought, oh, what is the matter with this man? Here he is, you know, he's just been handed this wonderful gift. And he says, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yes.
I really would love to know what made him make that choice.
Yes.
Because I think it's probably a fascinating story of why he might have made that decision.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I write. Like, I like to take a situation like that, and that's a great starting point for a story, actually, to take a character, give them an opportunity that most people would go, this is tremendous, and then not let them pick it, and then back up one step and go, okay, what happened the day before? What was his journal? What was in his journal the day before he got that phone call? What was life like the year before? Because if you think of that as like the last scene of a story, there's probably a really good one right behind it.
Sherry, you write that story, and we will all read it. I promise you we'll read it. And I was just thinking that I love stories. You know, I like things to happen. And I've been very careful not to give away the plot of your book. You know, we talked about it, about the characters, but we didn't tell everything that happens in the book. Because for me, the pleasure is in discovering that for yourselves. And I tried to give my listeners the opportunity of finding out for themselves what happens next. I mean, they know that the book ends and begins with fishing and that there's
That's
a shooting.
That's not too much. That's all right.
And there's a whole lot that happens in between. But the joy of being carried along by a story, that's why I read. I want to be, I want it to take me someplace else.
I do too.
Yeah,
that's one of the great things about coming on this trip is I got to read on the airplane. Well, actually, I graded papers for most of the way down here on the airplane, but then I finished. And so I have my reading for my return trip.
Oh, what are you reading?
Well, I'm going to read The Blind Assassin by Margaret Atwood.
Oh,
because
yes.
I have a thesis student who's working on a novel that she thinks is shaped like Atwood's The Blind Assassin. I haven't read that one, so I'm reading that. And then I'm reading The Stone Raft by Jose Saramago.
Oh, yes.
And I've just found him, and I'm behind. So he's my secret pleasure of just what I want to be. I want to learn what he does and how he does it. I've only read a few chapters of that book, and I don't get to do a lot of reading when I'm teaching.
Yes.
Because, well, I do a ton of reading, but it's for my classes.
Of course.
So I don't get to do a lot for pleasure when I'm teaching. And so I keep my secret stash for when I get when I can slide one in, tuck it into my life somewhere.
What else is in the books that you're eager to get to?
Well, I want to read again Beautiful Swimmers by William Warner.
I don't know.
Oh, it's like 1976, and I think it won the Pulitzer. It's
really?
A nonfiction book about the Chesapeake Bay blue crab and the history of crabbing. And the book that I'm working on right now has, it's a minor character. It's my main character's husband, who is a waterman, and I need to learn. I know the real basic stuff about it, but I need to go deeper into that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one thing that I'm reading. And then in the book I'm working on right now, my main character thinks of herself as a religious leader, as a spiritual guru. And whether she is or isn't, well, she can be if she wants to. But I'm needing to read some Thomas Merton and a little Dalai Lama. So I've got a good blend of things that I'm planning to do. Some of it is fiction. A lot of it's not right now.
Is she based on any real character?
Well, no, not really. All my characters have a little bit of me in them.
Yes.
But I hope that I hide it. You know, so I don't think of them as me. Like, I take a quality that I have, and then I marry that to something that's totally not me. I need that connection with the character, but I also really hope I don't write the same story over and over. That's one of my big fears, is what I'm going to find out I've done when I'm 80.
Yeah,
and
you don't
write
the same story over and over. It's different every time. And you usually write in the first person, don't you?
That is my natural mode, I
yes.
think. My novel, The Firefly Cloak, and that's the one that was published in 2006. So it precedes The Sweet In Between. That one is in third person, and that one is written from three different points of view. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. And I think I worked that out. I did that very deliberately because I didn't only want to do voice pieces. And I wanted the flexibility of third person to be able to do a little bit of commentary on the character in addition to what the character would be experiencing mm-hmm. herself. Mm-hmm. And so that was that one is in third person. I think everything else I've published is in first person.
It gives you, when you're in third person, it gives you a little distance
right.
from your characters. Whereas if you're in first person, you're right there inside their head.
Right.
I was so impressed with the way that you did that, because to write from the persona of a 17-year-old girl who's underprivileged, living in a crowded household, not much time for introspection, very little privacy, lots of trouble, and yet she's articulate. I thought her vocabulary was appropriate for it. I wondered about her reading habits, because she was so well-spoken, but I thought, well, I don't know how the poor child could have, you know, she has no privacy, any time to read. But somewhere in there, she's been exposed to good reading material. But that is not an easy thing to do, that you pulled off
with that voice.
Yeah, with that voice.
Well, her English teacher is her biggest influence.
That's right.
And
Mrs.
so that's her one real friend at school.
Of course.
But what she's reading is Shakespeare, and she's not into it at all. But she is into Miss Brady. And mm-hmm. so there is, I think that's kind of not surprising. You know, sometimes voices and characters come to me and it feels almost channeled. Like, I feel like I get a voice and I can really push. I can go fast with it. And sometimes I work and work and work on it. And I don't know. I wish I did know that magic thing that makes one just like click and to have a character the way that Kenny came to me. This book was one I couldn't stop writing. This was a book I wrote from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. every morning from September through February of 1 year. And I was teaching full time and I was directing the creative writing program. And I was so worried that the administrative job was going to keep me from doing my writing. I usually can't write at all when I'm teaching. It requires so much. And this one just was a rush. I had to do it. I didn't actually write on the days that I was teaching. I would write on days that I was working, but not in the classroom. But that voice was so much in me. It was such, the voice was easy. There are things that I don't know about being 17. Like, I think probably she should have had a cell phone, but she didn't. But she is poor, mm-hmm. so maybe she couldn't have a cell phone, you know. Mm-hmm. But, like, there are things that I don't know about being 17 now. But I really think that emotionally, I got it.
And that's funny, because that's one of the things that Caitlin Flanagan mentioned about the vampire series. She said, how come none of those girls have a cell phone?
Really?
But I think in your situation, I think I would have been surprised if Kenny'd had a cell
right.
phone. Yeah. And
who would she call?
Who would she call? There was never a moment in my reading that when I was thinking, no, wait a minute. This girl's only 7. The voice was so powerful, and the sense of place throughout. It just carried me through the story.
Thank you.
Yeah. I meant to spend more time talking about your other books, but I'll just mention them. The other books are The Rapture of Canaan, the one that she was Oprah'd for. The Firefly Cloak. Yeah, I've got them on another
Firefly
page here.
Firefly Cloak was my most recent one before this one. My very first novel is called Bitterroot Landing.
Yes.
And that one was before The Rapture of Canaan.
Uh-huh.
And then I did A Gracious Plenty.
Yes.
And that's my magical book. That's one that's where I let my imagination really go. So half the characters in that book are dead, mm-hmm. and half the characters are alive, and my character is really moving between the two worlds. Mm-hmm. That was a lot of fun to write, mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. And then there's Firefly Cloak,
mm-hmm.
and now The Sweet In-Between.
When you mentioned that writing the same book all that, no way. Each of these has a very distinctive voice and a very distinctive plot. So
Thank you. Just
keep writing.
Well, if anybody wants to go to my website, it's www.sherryreynolds.com, and there are little excerpts from each of my books there that you can sample. And then there are also notes for students, because a lot of times if students are writing papers, there hasn't been a lot done on me and they need more information. So there are little resources for students about each book. And then I also have a play called Orabelle's Wheelbarrow that was published in Blackbird, an online journal that comes out of Richmond, Virginia. And you can read that in its entirety from my website. It links to Blackbird. And so that play is there. And that play is one of my novels that didn't work out as a novel. And when I turned it in, my agent or my editor once said, "This seems over the top. It's way too theatrical." And I'm like, "Well, okay. I always wanted to learn to write a play." So I did it as a play. And I got to see that one produced down in Orlando, Florida, through the Women Playwrights Initiative. It won a competition for them. So it was produced at the Orlando Repertory Theater. Did that play. So,
will there be movies?
Well, I don't know. So far, there haven't been any movies, but you never know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't worry too much about it. Mm-hmm. It would be nice to make some money, but I write novels. I think it would be really cool for somebody to take an idea that was mine that came out as a book and then reimagine that and produce it. I'd like to see it, but I wouldn't mistake it for my book. You know, that's not what I do.
Right. Well, it's been so good to have you here, Sherry. To me, there's nothing better than talking with a writer about her own work.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Really appreciate your being here. And I certainly enjoyed reading your book and also discussing it with you. Want to give special thanks to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show, and Robin Pressman, the program director here at KRCB, and to all of you out there who find the time to listen. Suzanne, will you join me on the air and let's talk a bit about what we're going to do on our next show? I think our listeners are going to like it.
Okay. Good evening.
Yeah. And you've talked to our next guest, to Eva Rutland. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, actually, I've not spoken with Eva Rutland. I've spoken with her daughter, her namesake, Eva Fields. No, it's not her daughter. It's her granddaughter. And her granddaughter, Eva Fields, helped publish or reissue this book by her grandmother, Eva Rutland, called When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story.
Yeah. I read the book, and I just feel as though I know Eva Rutland already, because she is a natural-born storyteller. And her style is just so winning and so winsome. And talking about her raising these four lively children, it's just a delight. Of course, there's a more serious side to it as well, because they were living in the South for part of the time when segregation was still the rule, long before the civil rights laws were passed. And she presents that in a very even-handed way, how difficult it was for her children to not be able to go swimming in the public swimming pool. But it's not a polemic. She doesn't dwell on the things that they couldn't do. She's certainly found lots of things that the children could do. And she was the Girl Scout leader. I think she was probably the Boy Scout leader, too. And the children were just so interesting. I can't wait to meet her daughter, Ginger, who will be here with her and will be on the air.
Yes, Ginger Rutland will be in the studio as well as Eva Fields, along with Eva Rutland, the author of When We Were Colored. And I think that not only finding out Eva Rutland's story that you're just outlining for us, but to talk to the daughter, Ginger, who had this incredible mother, and then to talk to the granddaughter, Eva Fields, who they seem to have this tight intergenerational bond, and for this whole world to be opened up to Eva. And they've really approached the publication of this book as a real family endeavor. And I think that their story is as interesting as Eva's story herself.
Yeah, and it's so unusual. Eva writes the memoir, which was first published in 1964 and has just been reissued. Her daughter, Ginger, of course, is in the memoir as a child, and we have the opportunity to talk with her, and then with the granddaughter, who can reflect on the family stories that she's heard. So we'll get three different points of view. I just can't wait. I think it's going to be a wonderful show.
And they are appearing all over the Bay Area. They live in the Sacramento area and will be coming down here to talk with us here in the studio. And it's something that I know they're really reaching out to school children. They make appearances in schools and at libraries. And so I feel very fortunate. And in fact, this book came to my attention at the Sonoma County Book Festival in this past fall. Eva came up to us and showed me the book and talked to me a little bit about it, and I haven't been able to get her out of my head, so I'm really glad we've been able to book her on the show.
I'm really looking forward to it. I want to read to our listeners what Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and former speaker of the California State Assembly, says about the book. Here's a quote from Willie. Eva Rutland's chronicle of child rearing during the transition from segregation to civil rights is warm, poignant, and funny. It's also a powerful object lesson in how and why women, as mamas and grandmothers, have long anchored the soul of Black America. Isn't that a great quote?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that now is a time to hear it.
It couldn't be more timely.
Yeah, couldn't be more timely.
And that show will be airing on March 11th, Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock on Novel Idea. And we'll be reminding our listeners again over the air as we promote that show.
Okay. Before we ring off and say goodnight, Rosemary, I also think I want to remind the listeners of some of the books Sherry Reynolds talked about this evening.
Oh, please do.
Yeah, they might be interested in that, because Sherry was telling us what she's been reading lately, and you might be interested as well. The Blind Assassin by Margaret Atwood, and an author that you seemed to know of, but this is my first hearing of him, Josh Saramago's The Stone Raft.
Jose
Saramago's
yes.
The Stone Raft. Sorry, I can't read my own writing here. And then Beautiful Swimmers by William Warner, which was a Pulitzer Prize winning book, but it's about the crabbing industry of all things.
Yeah, I'm always interested to ask the writers who come in what they're reading, because there are three interesting books for our listeners to add to their list.
Along with Sherry Reynolds, The Sweet in Between. I also want to give credit to the opening music by Liz Story, and the vocal music this evening has been by Catherine McInnes, and I think we'll go out on Catherine's Discovering Gravity. So thanks, Rosemary, for giving me the opportunity to join you tonight.
Sure. And again, we remind our listeners that there's no such thing as too many books.
Absolutely.
Good night, all.
Just as a leaf takes flight, discovering gravity, I feel the need to fall. Surrender and fall.